You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Dressed to Kill by Sonia Soraya, with photo illustration by Max O'Matic. In BBC America sleeper hit Killing Eve, the romance and rivalry between two very different women is waged through the universal language of style. And in the opening illustration, the actresses are shown in various styles of clothing in an illustration montage. The jet-setting assassin Villanelle, played by British actress Jodie Comer in this year's breakout hit Killing Eve, has a weakness for fashion. She lives in Paris, which makes it easy, and charges a high price for performing precise, ruthless kills, thereby making her haute couture habit affordable. Throughout the season, Villanelle's looks are their own subplot. She slips into a Berlin club wearing a dandified Dries Van Noten brocade suit. She sulkily attends mandatory psychiatric evaluation in a flouncy saccharine pink Molly Goddard gown, paired rebelliously with punky Balenciaga boots. In a gripping scene from the first episode, Villanelle takes time to ask her mark about the designer of an especially sumptuous silk throw he owns, before skewering him through the eye with a poison-filled hairpin. Showrunner Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who adapted Luke Jennings' novellas into the 8-episode first season for BBC America, has made subverting viewers' expectations about on-screen women into a mordant art. Killing Eve became a word-of-mouth sleeper hit this spring, increasing its audience by 86% from the first episode, an unheard-of streak of viewership gains. BBC America was so high on its expectations for the series that it was renewed for a second season, before season one even aired. The gamble paid off. The drama was nominated for 2 Emmys, including a lead actress nomination for star Sandra Oh, the first performer of Asian descent in the category. Killing Eve is not just an overnight sensation, but a milestone for inclusion in the industry. Waller-Bridge's show entangles the viewer in a juicy cat-and-mouse story that pits two unlikely women against each other. Villanelle pursues and is pursued by MI5 investigator Eve, played by O, a frumpy, married bureaucrat who is titillated by Villanelle. The investigator falls for the assassin's daring, flirty methods, and like the audience, she thrills to the high drama of Villanelle's life. The fabulous power, the unbridled violence, the satisfaction of watching a pretty girl repeatedly outmaneuver the world around her. Eve describes Villanelle to the police sketch artist in purple prose, dwelling on her cat-like eyes and very delicate features. When she first sees photos of Villanelle's bloody handiwork, she can't help uttering an exhilarated cool. Unexpectedly, despite the investigator's Uniqlo wardrobe, battered anorak and awful green scarf covered in zebras, a similar one can be purchased on Amazon.com for $7, Villanelle is intrigued by Eve, too. At first, it's just the excitement of someone paying attention to her, but gradually it becomes more complex. Villanelle sees a side of Eve that Eve would rather not show the world. Quite romantically, that side is communicated by her unruly, fabulous hair. Villanelle comes to practically fetishize it, recognizing accurately that Eve could be a wilder woman than she's allowing herself to be. In one of the most erotic moments of the show, Eve opens up her lost suitcase, only to discover that Villanelle has stocked it with decadent designer clothing, all in her exact sizes. Swigging wine, she tries on a dress, a Roland Mouret black and ivory number, and is stunned at the femme fatale she sees in the mirror. As the show's costume designer, Phoebe Degay, put it, Villanelle wants to manipulate Eve into seeing her own beauty. It's this seeing that makes the show so addictive, especially for female viewers. Eve sees Villanelle in the precision of her handiwork. Villanelle sees Eve through the tangle of her hair. Killing Eve plumbs feminine allure in new and interesting ways, as Eve and Villanelle find cozy, familiar methods of cornering the other. Villanelle barges in on Eve to eat her leftover shepherd's pie. Eve politely stops in for tea and cake at the home of Villanelle's ex-lover. The most taut moments come when Eve is alone, but immersed in Villanelle, be it when she's wearing the high-fashion clothes the assassin gifted her, or trashing her well-appointed apartment. Eve appears to almost welcome the incursion of Villanelle's ridiculous, petulant personality, but she's increasingly made aware that the killer's seductive qualities are just the surface of an actual psychopath. There's something to be said for women watching other women and seeing past the surface to appreciate what's beyond mere superficial styling. When Eve and Villanelle first glimpse each other, it's in a mirror in the women's bathroom. But each takes note of the other's reflection. The series' core is less two adversaries battling each other than it is two women shadowboxing with the parts of themselves they have unwittingly seen reflected in the other. Admiration Society, we ask novelists to tout their September must-reads and indulge in a little peer promotion. Vanity Fair recommends Transcription by Kate Atkinson. Atkinson shows off her signature humor and versatility in her highly anticipated 10th novel, Transcription, published by Little Brown, which centers on a young British woman entrenched in counter-fascist espionage at the beginning of World War II. Kate recommends French Exit by Patrick DeWitt. DeWitt's latest is like a cross between a Feydeau farce and a Buñuel film, as one after another eccentric characters enter an ever more claustrophobic apartment DeWitt surprises at every turn. Patrick recommends The Reservoir Tapes by John McGregor. A young tourist goes missing in a small English village, and an interviewer arrives to interrogate the locals. The bulk of the novel is made up of their stories. McGregor has an uncanny ear and such an elegant way with words. John recommends When the Emperor Was Divine by Julie Otsuka. It shouldn't need demonstrating yet again that the dehumanization of people is wrong, but Otsuka's masterful 2002 novel, with its family separations and internment camps, does just that. More on books, bound to please. This season's exquisite new coffee table books open doors to art, music, fashion, and more. Farah Pahlavi, former Empress of Iran, writes, "The modern art in the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art reflects how Iran, during the late 1960s, found itself at the center of East and West. I view art and culture as an eternal, permanent institution." Donna DeSalvo, senior curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art, writes, "What may be most valuable in Warhol now is his recognition from the first clean 1961 Coca-Cola bottle on that he too wanted to believe, and that every good image in art and in commerce is a construction." Zadie Smith, author of Swing Time, writes, "An awareness of the proximity and the ever-present threat of poverty and abjection connect Taylor's work to the hip-hop he loves and references, mining Kendrick Lamar for titles or Tupac's face for an installation." Ann Patchett, author of Commonwealth, writes, "I swore I wouldn't write about what Nashville was. I would write about what Nashville is. After all, what Nashville is and what it was bear pretty much no relationship to each other. Even the river has changed." And in a photograph by Tim Hout, shows Jimmy Nelson, Homage to Humanity by Jimmy Nelson, published by Rizzoli. Andy Warhol, From A to B and Back Again by Donna DeSalvo, published by Whitney Museum of American Art. Iran Modern, The Empress of Art by Viola Raquel Bolo and Miranda Darling, published by Asuline. Michael Jackson on the Wall, published by Nicholas, written by Nicholas Cullinan, and published by National Portrait Gallery. To Sing America, The Harlem Renaissance at 100 by Will Haygood, published by Rizzoli Electra. Nashville, Scenes from the New American South by Ann Patchett and Heidi Ross, published by Harper Design. Henry Taylor by Charles Gaines, Rachel Kadzi Ganesh, Sarah Lewis, and Zadie Smith, published by Rizzoli Electra. Alaya by Azadine Alaya, published by Rizzoli. City of Angels, Houses and Gardens of Los Angeles, by Jennifer Ash Ruddick and Firoa Zahedi, published by Vendome. Italiana, Italy Through the Lens of Fashion, 1971 to 2001, by Maria Luisa Frisa, Gabriele Monti, and Stefano Tonchi, published by Marsilio. Mark Jacobs, Unseen, 1994 to 2012, by Robert Ferrer, published by Abrams.
Thank you.
Keziah Weir writes on accoutrement for the Vanities. Time out. Golden State Warrior swingman Andre Iguodala has racked up 3 championship wins, 1 finals MVP award, and a healthy obsession with luxury timepieces. Photograph by Cheyenne Azgarnia, showing the various watches and the wearer. Time to shine. Iguodala purchased this platinum and diamond Rolex masterpiece to celebrate winning an Olympic gold medal in 2012. 3-time NBA champion Andre Iguodala's watch collection is so extensive that he likes to match his timepiece to the city he's playing in. New York, Rolex Daytona in rose gold. Los Angeles, diamond-encrusted Audemars Piguet Royal Oak. Chicago, IWC Big Pilot's watch. At home, just outside Oakland, California, he likes the understated class of an all-black Panerai. My style is kind of like my game, he says. Very versatile. Wrist jewelry aside, Iguodala, who has graced the front rows of Dior and Lanvin shows, has also settled comfortably into an off-court uniform. I have my Steve Jobs look, he says, though he prefers blazers, jeans, and designer sneakers to mock turtlenecks. The athlete's horology fixation is all-consuming. He revels in details, like how many parts make up a particular model, sometimes thousands, and has a timepiece style idol, Jay-Z. He even got his diving license to go along with his Audemars Piguet offshore diver. When I watch interviews, Iguodala says, I'm looking at the guy's wrist, trying to see what type of watch he has. Thank you. In more from the Vanities, Maggie Bullock writes on fashion, fake news, faux fur rules the runway. And in the photograph by Kiernan Monaghan and Theo Vamvunikas, a fur coat by Givenchy, very retro-looking black and tan, almost like a zebra stripe fur coat with no collar and a black leather tie belt. When even Donatella Versace, goddess of high glitz, announces, as she did this spring, fur, I am out of that, you know you're in the midst of a moment. Within the past year, the houses of Gucci, Michael Kors, Tom Ford, and Furla have pledged to reduce and eliminate the use of fur in future collections. Joining the ranks of already fur-free Armani, Stella McCartney, Tommy Hilfiger, Ralph Lauren, and Calvin Klein. And in a sweeping move, retailer Net-a-Porter announced last year it would no longer sell real fur to its 3.1 million luxury-loving customers. Accordingly, the fall 2018 runways were full of, well, fakes. In New York, Michael Kors delivered a trim leopard trench. In Milan, Gucci's Alessandro Michele stayed true to Margot Tenenbaum with a clutch coat of butterscotch-hued fluff. And Paris's fiercest waiting list of the season are doubtless for the half-dozen faux that set the tone for Claire Waite Keller's second ready-to-wear collection for Givenchy. Inspired by the gritty, glamorous 80s Berlin seen in the 2015 documentary B-movie Lust and Sound in West Berlin, the parade of faux opened with this lush black and caramel belted overcoat. Both hot and a little haughty, with just the right hint of mob wife, it is chic enough to seduce even the most stalwart fake fur skeptic. Still more from the Vanities, Beauty, bar none. On the eve of New York City Ballet's Fall Gala, indulge in the routines and retreats that keep principal dancer Lauren Lovett looking and feeling en pointe. My products, cleanser, Youth Corridor Dual Action Cleanser, to remove stage lashes, Mary Kay Oil-Free Eye Makeup Remover. Skincare treatment, Youth Corridor No Peel Peel. Lotion, Palmer's Cocoa Butter Formula Massage Lotion for Stretch Marks, made for pregnant women. Moisturizer, Youth Corridor Daily Hydration Cream. Pancake Makeup Dissolver, Aveeno Ultra Calming Makeup Removing Wipes. Calming Scents, doTERRA Oils in Douglas Fir, Balance, and Citrus Bliss. Perfume, Bleu de Chanel. Deodorant, Old Spice Desperado. Powder, Chanel Poudre Lumiere. Shampoo, Oribe Shampoo for Moisture and Control. For Natural Curls, Hask Argan Oil from Morocco. Go-to hairstyle, French Twist. Nails, OPI Big Apple Red. Bath or Shower, Bath with Lush Audrey Hepburn Funny Face Inspired Pink Bath Bomb. Morning Routine, the Meditation App. My Places for Healing Body and Mind, Yang Earth Acupuncture with Rebecca Krause Carrolls. To Stretch, Pure Yoga. Best Workout, Ballet. For open classes at all levels, try Steps on Broadway. Facialist, Youth Corridor by Dr. Gerald Imber. Ask for Denise. Hair Salon, Gemini 14. Best Manicure, Spring Sun Nail Spa. Healthy Fare, Candle Cafe West. Juice Bar, Joe and the Juice between 71st and 72nd on Columbus. Pro tip, order the vegan shake. Post-show drinks, the Empire Rooftop. Take a walk on the High Line. And at Juice Bar, the shake is spelled V-E-G-A-I-N.
Thank you.
onto collections, The Art of Mama Fierce by Kimberly Drew. Tina Knowles Lawson is walking me through her art collection on a bright Friday afternoon. A smooth figure carved from wood by the sculptor Elizabeth Catlett is situated near her Hollywood Homes' front door in a museum-quality case. To the left, a set of glinting Fabergé eggs. Photographs by Gillian Laub. Opening photo, Tina Knowles Lawson in her living room with Kimberly Drew, the Metropolitan Museum of Art's social media manager, who is known online as @MuseumMammy. To the left, a set of glinting Fabergé eggs are on display in a glass bureau, which also houses a handwritten letter from Michelle Obama, thanking Lawson for her support on Barack's 2008 campaign. Two paintings, one by Hale Woodruff, the other Charles Alston, are mounted in the staircase and just above the grand piano. From every vantage point, the home is saturated with stunning mementos of Black life. While some art collections feel like a mausoleum, Lawson's comes alive as she stops before various pieces, sharing anecdotes and art history lessons. Earlier that morning, when I typed what I'd been told was Lawson's address into my smartphone, I had visions of being blindfolded upon arrival and taken to a remote location, wherein the interview might actually commence. But I did indeed arrive at her house, which she shares with her husband Richard Lawson. The property is equal parts old Hollywood glamour, the architect completed work in 1924, and Rodeo Drive chic. Lawson designed the infinity pool installed along the front path. I found Lawson in the kitchen applying mascara with an assistant, a stylist, and a makeup artist standing by. The night before, she told me, she had dropped by her elder daughter's house to collect a few outfits for the day's shoot, calling to mind the shoes and accessories my own mother has expropriated from my wardrobe over the years. It turns out that even, and perhaps especially, if you're the biggest pop star in the world, when your mother needs an outfit, she needs an outfit. Next photos, Elegant Garveyite by Houston artist Robert Pruitt, who is known for his versatility in both style and medium. And Me Too by Genevieve Gagnard, a Los Angeles-based artist whose work explores the intersections of race, class, and femininity. Because this is, after all, the mother of Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriters Beyoncé Knowles Carter and Solange Knowles Ferguson, two women whose prodigious individual musical talents have vaulted them into a new realm of celebrity, whose privacy is guarded above all else, and who mutually agree that much of their success is owed to their mother's powerful influence and care. I think it's something to say that my introduction to art was Black art, Solange said in a January interview with Surface magazine, referring to her mother's collection, then housed in their Houston childhood home. When my kids were growing up, it was really important to me that they saw images of African Americans, Lawson tells me. I'm so happy that I did, because both of them are really aware of their culture. And I think a lot of that had to do with looking at those images every day, those strong images. And while music might first come to mind when thinking about Beyoncé and Solange, visual art has taken an increasingly prominent place in the lives of both women. This spring, Solange, who has previously presented work at New York's Guggenheim Museum and London's Tate Modern, debuted Metatronia, Metatron's Cube, an interdisciplinary performance project about the creative process at Los Angeles's Hammer Museum. Just days before my interview with her mother, Beyoncé and her husband, Jay-Z, dropped the instantly viral first video for their surprise joint album, Everything Is Love, which accompanies the bombastic champagne trap song Ape Shit, and which was shot exclusively in and around Paris's iconic Louvre Museum. Born in Galveston, Texas in 1954, Lawson, along with six siblings, two of whom have since passed away, was raised by her mother, a seamstress, and father, a longshoreman. "I grew up really poor, and I had a lot of shame about it," Lawson says. It was only later in life that she found out her mother had bartered sewing work to send her children to a costly Catholic school. Lawson long believed she'd never leave Galveston, but when she was 14, a female friend took her to Houston to see the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. "I saw those dancers and all those well-dressed black folks," she says. "It made me want to get out of my little town and have a bigger world." Half a decade later, during a year-long stint in Los Angeles, pursuing a career as a makeup artist, she made her first big art purchase, a $500 abstract painting from a furniture store. It was probably a reproduction, but it was so beautiful and it was in a frame. "I discovered then how important art is for your home. It made me feel good every day." Today, her collection has swelled to include works by artists ranging from Elizabeth Catlett, Romare Bearden, and Henry Osoa Tanner, the turn-of-the-century African-American expat who garnered huge success after moving to Paris, to more contemporary works by Toyin Oji Odutola, Kenyatta A.C. Hinkle, and Lawson's own niece, Dominique Beyoncé. Next photos, an untitled work by Kermit Oliver, who, Lawson says, couldn't care less about the fame or the fortune. And following her divorce in 2011, Noel says, "One of the things that made me the most happy was reading art books, like these on Radcliffe Bailey, Kermit Oliver, and Diego Rivera. I have a storage facility with probably every African-American artist history. I love collecting and knowing the history of the artist," says Lawson, who has always seen her relationship to art as more spiritual than material. In front of a painting by Kermit Oliver, she delivers an impromptu trivia session on the Texan mixed-media artist. "He's the only American in history who designed scarves for Hermes, yet he nevertheless chose to work as a mail sorter at a Waco post office. It kept him normal," she says. Over the course of our tour, Lawson continually expresses that art has been a major tool in helping her find joy and retain a sense of self, despite dedicating so much of her life to her children. In the wake of her 2011 divorce from her first husband, Matthew Knowles, Lawson threw herself into work, running her popular Houston salon and doing wardrobe for her elder daughter. "I was really depleted," she says. "I remember Beyoncé saying to me, 'Mama, what will make you laugh? What makes you happy?' She started reading art books and going out dancing. She called an old friend, the artist Monica Stewart, and rekindled their relationship. Today, three of Stewart's paintings are on view in Lawson's house. One, an abstract titled Adoration, was commissioned by Lawson. It's supposed to be my two girls looking up at me." Forging such relationships with artists accounts for part of her collection, but she also acquires pieces at auction, though she's the first to admit that the auction house can be a dangerous place for her. The first time she tried bidding over the phone, Lawson says, she planned to purchase something inexpensive just to get a feel for the process. "I got on," she says, "and next thing I know, I bought a Sam Gilliam, I bought two Picasso lithographs. I was like, what did I do? I tried not to buy them, but they found me and they threatened to sue me." I think of the Instagram video Lawson posted earlier this year at the Waco Theater Center's annual Wearable Art Gala. Her six-year-old granddaughter, Blue Ivy, is perched between her parents, gleefully locked in a bidding war against Tyler Perry for a painting of Sidney Poitier. The Waco Theater Center co-founded by Lawson and her husband in 2017, is a large-scale mentoring program that immerses children, the group's angels and warriors, in art programming as they journey from adolescence into adulthood. The first trip Lawson took with the angels, she says, was to see a performance by the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. As our tour comes to a close, I take one last look around. In an enclave separating the sunroom from the kitchen, there is a panel by the emerging artist Genevieve Gagnard, situated under a lithograph by the storied muralist John Biggers, one of Lawson's favorite artists. Biggers' print is one of five that were made to accompany Our Grandmothers by Maya Angelou. Two more spill into the adjoining room. The poem, which Angelou wrote for the 1993 presidential inauguration, celebrates the endurance of the black matriarch despite the ills of slavery and systematic oppression. When you learn, teach, the poem reads. When you get, give. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.